Okay. I want to talk about the precepts. I've completely rewritten this chapter, so you'll have to pardon me if I am not so extemporaneous in presenting it. The precepts are part of Zen study, as well as a part of Zen practice, and are handled as koans at the very end of the practice, both in the Rinzai and in the Soto schools. You know, at first it may seem that the ten precepts are negatively expressed commandments, like the Ten Commandments. But in fact, they don't carry the meaning "thou shalt not," but rather "there is no," implying there is no killing, no stealing, no lying, and so on, in the mind. Now, some commentaries by Dogen Zenji on the Ten Precepts carry the injunction, "must not." But this must be understood for the purposes of training. Even "must not" can be a compassionate injunction, as a device to reach realization that fundamentally there is no killing in the mind. You must not kill. Like that. So even with imperative implications, moral injunctions are positive expressions of love. It is an act of love sometimes to say, "don't do that." Either way, as a presentation of unity with all beings, or as a corrective device, the ten precepts are expressions of compassion. So we can say that they are simply ten different ways of showing love. The ten precepts formulate the realization of inherent good. This good is not the opposite of bad. It is self-nature, Buddha nature. All beings by nature are Buddha. Only their delusions and attachments keep them from bearing witness to that fact. The precepts are a guide out of self-centered delusion and attachment to the Buddha's own full and complete realization of truth and compassion. Now, historically, the Ten Precepts, like the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, were for the sake of disciples of Shakyamuni Buddha. They were to be applied individually, and all beings might thus eventually be saved. In fact, all beings were saved with the enlightenment of each disciple. But the Buddha was a wandering saint, you know. There is no indication that he sought to change the social system of his time, other than to form a sangha of truth-seeking monks and nuns within it. He did go to a battlefield one time and seek to stop the battle, and he did plead with a king not to invade another kingdom. what the system was for him and for all teachers of that time and for centuries onward, a given. It's only in the last 150 or so years that we have been looking closely at system as something to be corrected, political, economic system. The Buddha was not faced with the dangerous competition between nations that literally threatens to blow up the world today. He was not faced with probable biological holocaust. So you may wonder what he would do in such circumstances. Modern Buddhists must grapple with the fact that exclusiveness in the application of Buddhist insights has led to the decline of the Dharma in Asia. This is particularly true in Mahayana Buddhism. Monastic entities that were really islands of truth became more and more isolated and gradually have died out for lack of organic communication with the rest of humanity. Reformed Buddhism, on the other hand, has largely watered down the authentic truths of the founding teachers and permitted the poisons of acquisitive society to enter the bloodstream of the Dharma itself. Now, certainly, hermetic Buddhism is a vain ideal. So how should the truths of Buddhism be applied in today's world? This is a matter for the individual to grapple with, and it is also a matter, I am convinced, for the Sangha itself to grapple with, as a Sangha. So, the 10 grave precepts are as follows. Number one, no destroying of life. You know, there is fundamentally no birth and death as we die and are reborn. Yamada Roshi says, life is a phase of no life. Life and death are a phase of no life and no death. But it is killing the spirit that may realize such a fact. That violates this precept. We kill that spirit in ourselves and in others when we brutalize human potential or potential of any kind. And we can brutalize with a word or an action sometimes. It doesn't take a bomb or a club. Now, it follows that war and other acts of organized violence are, including social repression, are massive violations of this precept. And it is ironic that sometimes one can be considerate of the feelings of friends and neighbors while working at a job that directly contributes to widespread suffering. Now, on the other end of the scale, we find Jain monks filtering their water so that the microscopic beings that are in the water will not be killed when it is drunk. And recent studies purport to show that carrots and cabbages have feelings. So, what can we do? The answer, I think, is to eat and drink in the spirit of grateful sharing. I have heard that Alan Watts was once asked why he was a vegetarian. And he said, because cows scream louder than carrots. And I think we can learn from this answer. Each of us must draw the line individually. There is no rule. Some people will refuse to eat kidneys and brains. Some people will refuse to eat red meat. Some people will not drink milk. Some people, like me, will eat what is served to them, but will limit their purchases of animal products. So you must draw your own line, considering your own health, as well as the health of other beings. Number two, no taking things of others. Well, there is no stealing and nothing to be stolen. When Samoan people come to the United States, or to Australia, I imagine, but they come especially to Hawaii and the United States because they can travel freely there, they are surprised to find that what belongs to you doesn't also belong to me. Quite a cultural shock. But to think possessively is the violation of this precept. The person who steals is deficient in love. He or she needs something from others. Such a person structures a system of innocence upon fundamental innocence, and fundamental innocence is thereby obscured. Did you steal that? No, I didn't. See? That is the structure of innocence, obscuring original innocence. Still, we live in an acquisitive society, and we cannot live outside that society. We participate involuntarily in thievery. Can't be helped. We can only begin with ourselves to express our compassion for all creatures and things. Even picking a flower is a kind of stealing. And we pick it as we accept food for our table. So like the precept of no killing, no stealing has its application within the individual, within the immediate Buddha Sangha, and outside in the workaday world. The Buddha's injunction in the Eightfold Path that we must choose the right vocation means choosing a vocation that involves minimal exploitation and suffering. Our habits of consumption support massive and irredeemable exploitation of people, animals, trees, plants, earth, water, and air. But we can generate great power when we gather in communities in agreement to support this this precept and to conserve the energy of the universe and to protect its beings and its elements. Number three, no misuse of six. I had a hard time translating this, this title. because the word lust is in there, or something equivalent to that. And lust can be a very powerful and positive kind of energy. It can be used or misused. So finally I hit upon misuse of sex. The mind is completely pure, and there is nothing to be called sexual exploitation there. We obscure this purity with clouds of coveting and scheming. Sex is sharing, and when it becomes using, it is perverted. A violation of this precept, and also of the earlier two precepts, also. For it involves brutalizing and taking things of others. Like the thief, the person who indulges in casual sex may be lacking in the love that rises from within, seeking to draw something from the outside. Another kind of casual sex rises from a lack of confidence in the self as the agent of the Dharma, and it becomes a kind of false sharing, prostitution of the spirit. At our two training centers, we generally admit single people only, at Maui Zendo and Kokoan Zendo. But on a space available basis, we may admit a committed couple, as long as their relationship is reasonably secure, and there is little risk of their distracting others with continually fighting and making up, not to mention distracting themselves. Single people who are accustomed to active sexuality on a relatively short-term basis, we encourage to remain as community members until they are settled in a true investment, or until they are fully prepared for a period of sublimation during their residency. Now, there are some people who have been conditioned by over-literal Catholic teaching, or who have been followers of Yogananda or certain other Hindu teachers, and have come to the Buddhism with ideals of purity that interfere with their practice. The person for whom sexual purity is a problem has little energy left over for zazen. Sex is neither pure nor impure. It is our attitude about it that can be disruptive or conducive to the practice. If the partners are committed to one another, their sexual fulfillment in each other can be a positive support to their zazen. 4. Now speaking untruths. Under all circumstances, being true is first and foremost loyalty to the mind, to the equality and the distinctiveness of all things. The mind is profound and subtle, and appears in the phenomenal world with richness and variety. Efforts to deny or manipulate phenomena which obscure their essence violate this precept. For these efforts set up a structure of justification, a cloud of words and thoughts, and the Buddha Dharma is nowhere to be seen. Please understand this clearly. If a deranged person comes to the door and with a knife in his hand, maybe, and demands to see someone here, you know, what will you say? No? Oh, I'm sorry, you'll find him in Alice Springs, maybe you would say. Yes. It would not be in support of this precept to do otherwise. Your fundamental precept is to save all beings, to cut off poisons, to realize the Dharma, and to attain to the Buddha way. No dealing in spirits. It's very interesting that our modern word deal has an exact translation in the Chinese, using, selling, or receiving is the meaning of that rather obscure Chinese character that's used here. It referred originally to alcohol, but of course it relates to anything that clouds the mind. Certainly, excessive indulgence in TV or silly conversation could violate this precept. It's not possible for most people to do zazen after one beer or even one puff of a marijuana cigarette. Try sometime. It doesn't work. So at our training centers, we ban alcohol and dope. The rules specifically in this regard are, for residents of the center, no holding, no selling, no giving away, and no using. It's like the sign in the Haight-Ashbury Clinic in the old days. Exception comes with occasional parties where we share a bottle of wine with which to toast an honored guest. I found by long observation, it took me about 10 years to make up my mind about this, that people who have used marijuana heavily at one time in their life cannot use it for recreation in their free time without going off the track. Now, I'm sure that there are lots of exceptions to this, but of the people I see at the Maui Zendo who in past time have used marijuana a lot, and then on their Saturday afternoon and Sunday time off, they smoke it again, they have a hard time getting back into the practice on Monday and Tuesday. So I encourage such people to abstain. Now, smoking tobacco dulls our function too, besides being a smelly, untidy habit that divides the Sangha into smokers and non-smokers. I don't see so many smokers here. So maybe this caution isn't necessary. Not so necessary for us at Maui either. Maybe we'll eliminate this paragraph eventually. Fundamentally, everything is clear and pristine, but we must also consider the setting necessary to realize that fact fully. 6. No speaking of faults of others. Every person and everything is totally unique and completely equal. At the same time, each individual is evolving, and the fault is the very place where that person can grow. It is the weak place in one's character that is the potent place. It is through that spot, that fault, if you think of it like a fault in the earth, you see, it is that point in the earth where it is able to evolve and change and expand and contract. Okay. So we can encourage this growth in many ways, But gossip leads to a stereotype. And then two people agree about this fault in the third person, and it becomes an acknowledged fact. But really, it's only a shared perception. So it's the expression of that perception may actually hinder that person's growth. So, and actually the fabric of the Sangha can be damaged, perhaps beyond repair, by such critical conjecture. 7. No praising of yourself while abusing others. This is an extension of the preceding precept. A pernicious means of obscuring essential equality. Where does it come from? Again, it comes from lack of confidence in the self. As an agent of the Dharma, we seek to appear in a good light and to defend ourselves at the expense of others. Of course, this does not preclude correcting others. If someone is noisy during quiet time, then it is actually a protection of the Dharma to speak to that person gently and compassionately. The precepts are not narrow injunctions and always involve a well-developed sense of proportion. These sixth and seventh precepts are the easiest to violate. All the world is queer save me and thee, and sometimes I think thee is a little queer. I always thought was a Quaker proverb, but it precedes the Quakers back into the Elizabethan period. I looked it up in my dictionary of quotations. Thus we fall into the fundamental delusion of humanity. Eight. No sparing of the Dharma assets. You remember Michael's account of the Dharma. It has a number of aspects. But here we should consider it to be the Buddha's teachings on the one hand, and phenomena or things on the other. There is from the beginning no sparing of the Dharma assets. The truth is all about us, and richness is all about us. Tungen, the great disciple of Chukokshi, very early Tang period Chinese figure, speaking of the whole world, says within it there is gold that fills the land. Yes, everything is golden. But we tend to obscure this, again, by lack of confidence, knowing what to say about our practice here, what not to say, and so conservatively saying nothing. Refraining from encouraging others. And of course, I suppose the treasurer of your Sydney Zen group would find other applications of this precept too. Please be generous in sharing by means of your pledges or your dues. Number 9, no anger. And actually, again, from the beginning, there is no anger and nothing to be angry at. But in the rather demanding circumstances of a Zen training center, particularly during Sishin, we uncover old traumas that flare up. It can't be helped. Anger is one of the emotions, and emotion is the nature of vitality. If we recognize that our feelings rise from within and are not necessarily justified by what is happening outside, we can change through the acknowledgement, "This is my fault." Occasionally, however, we must raise our voice and assume a stern countenance. In appropriate circumstances, where the practice of others may be enhanced, this is not a violation of the precept. But self-indulgent anger, freely vented, separates rather than brings people together. I've never known a Zen teacher who did not have a hot temper. But when was that temper expressed or projected? It was when someone was tearing at the fabric of the Sangha or lying about the Dharma. Then there would be anger. But the response would be very mild if one of those teachers was offered even destructive seeming criticism. Very mild. No concern here at all. Toksan is one of the great teachers in our particular lineage. Had a attendant named Kaku. And one day, Kaku said to him, "Where have all the Buddhas and patriarchs gone?" And Toksan said, "What did you say?" And Kaku said, "I commanded an exceedingly fine racehorse to spring forth, but only a lame tortoise appeared." Toksan said nothing. It goes on. It's interesting. The next day, when Toksan came out of his bath, Kaku served him tea, and Toksan gave his shoulder a gentle pat. And Kaku said, "Ho ho, the old boss has noticed for the first time." And again, Toksan said nothing. Not ruffled in the least by this kind of attack or criticism. But it's that same Toksan who said, "If you say yes, you get 30 blows. If you say no, you get 30 blows." Same guy. Okay, closely allied to... closely allied to anger is hatred or holding a grudge, which is the perpetuation of an anger that somehow feeds the self-esteem, just as greed may feed ego preoccupation, and clinging to error may protect the self-image. Hatred is a poison that permanently sets people apart, creating and justifying violations of all the precepts, and permanently smothering any possibility of compassion. And finally, no slandering of the three treasures. The Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are above slander, of course, and slander itself is the three treasures. but it takes an opened eye to see this. Wanton slander of realization, the way, and the fellowship may destroy the enthusiasm of an earnest student and block her or his path to realization. Gossip, as I indicated, can destroy the very tissue of the Sangha, and inappropriate behavior as Buddhists can also be very harmful. Every Zen student is a leader of the Sangha, influencing all other students, but old-timers in particular have an important responsibility. Their action sets the tone at the training center, and the three treasures are brightened or blackened accordingly. Well, I have a 11th precept. And that relates to confidentiality. This is very important. The words of the teacher to the student are directed to that particular student. And if those words are repeated to others, it may confuse others, or it may create feelings of jealousy or envy or contempt or whatever. It's very tempting to say, Roshi said thus and so to me. Please do keep confidence in this matter. You know, if they were words of approval, then there's an implied put down of others. Keeping silent about one's own practice keeps the Sangha from becoming competitive and elitist. It is not necessary to speak of passing koans in order to establish yourself as a Zen student. Okay, now, just one more point here. I've heard that people say that Zen doesn't have any ethics. This is a kind of popular belief among people who have just read Suzuki and Watts and Blythe and Herrickel and such writers. This isn't so, you know. It's only that there are guides, such as these precepts, which help one to realize essential nature and to help one to help others realize that, and to encourage the richness and diversity of all things in the world. And we may also suppose that ethics are rather elementary kind of religious teaching. Maybe the first grade. Now that's not so either. As I said, these precepts form the very last step in formal koan study or formal soto shu practice. There's a nice story about Bird's Nest Roshi in this regard. Bird's Nest Roshi was a teacher who did zazen in the tree, and he had quite a reputation. The poet and statesman Po Chui, he was governor of his province and one of the great poets in the history of Chinese literature. You'll find his work translated in Arthur Whaley. Anyway, Po Chui heard about him and led his retinue into the forest to interview him. And there he was, up in the tree there during zazen. And Po Chui says, "Oh, Bird Nest, you look very insecure to me up there." And Brezhnev Droshchi looked down at the governor, see, and said, "Oh, governor, you look very insecure to me down there." Well, poor Chewy was intelligent enough to know what Brezhnev was referring to. You know, his position as governor, his position as a human being, indeed. So he asked another question. "Tell me, what is it that all the Buddhas taught?" So Brezhnev replied, quoting the Dhammapada, "Always do good, never do evil. Keep your mind pure. Thus all the Buddhas taught." So, Pochui said, "Well, always do good, never do evil, keep your mind pure. I knew that when I was 3 years old." "Yes," said Birdsnest, "the three-year-old child knows it, but the 80-year-old man cannot put it into practice." With that, I'll close. Thank you. Oh, Shikantaza. Yeah, Shikantaza. Is it one sitting? Let's see. Okay. For the next period, please let everything go and just sit. This is the practice of Shikantaza. It is not the practice for beginners or even relatively advanced students, but it's something that you should be familiar with. You should know what it is. So give it a try this time. Just face that empty stage, you see? Be that empty stage yourself. Did you see the movie 2001? Yeah. You remember that spaceship going through space. See? That's you. See? There's nothing at all. Please try it.